rendering badassery.
I guess that whole fuck it mentality can really go a long way. It's just, you know, people have worked in the past with what they have.
Right.
And so, you know, they end up going farther in that sense when you have that kind of strive to be like, you know what, I have this, I don't care. It's raw. It's, they almost look at it as like edgy.
It's like the punk rock DIY thing. Where it's like, right. I'm just going to do it, you know, with this shitty guitar. I'm just going to make an album. Who cares?
Exactly.
I think part of it too is like, if you are willing to just dive in and go forward, that maybe you don't have that, you know, self-criticism that slows people down. So maybe that's why they do well, because they're just like, they don't think about it.
Well, here's food for thought. So I was in a metal band, a black metal band.
I'm quite aware
of that. So thank you. So Norwegian black metal, they do not do anything where it's like top notch recording. I mean, no, they like, record like in a damn dungeon. It's like a dungeon.
Well, I remember that Cradle of Filth got shit for years for having really good studio quality albums.
Oh yeah. So did Dimmu. They all got that.
I just, have you read Lords of Chaos?
I've heard about it, but I haven't read it. I mean, I know the story. I've actually watched the documentary, but I haven't like read the book.
It's so terrifying that for people who don't know, it's the history of underground Norwegian black metal. I'd say like 40 to 50, no, more than that, because what's his name? Varg is almost in it throughout the whole book, but it focuses mostly on one band, Mayhem. And speaking of like low quality recordings, oh my God.
Right.
Those Mayhem recordings are just like, what the fuck?
And what's interesting with the like lead singer is they go into his history about how, you know, he was just crazy. He would take a dead bird and throw it in a bag and like smell it. And he would be like, oh, I'm smelling death. And then he would go out and scream. And that was the whole difference between, you know, kind of like doom metal or that kind of underground, like Cannibal Corpse, because they would do a low growl. But with black metal, it was like a screaming sound, because he basically described it as, you know, coming out of the grave, as if you were coming back alive. What would that be like?
Right.
And so that was kind of, you know, his mindset for that going into black metal. I mean, Mayhem was, they were nuts and I loved it.
Dead killed himself. They found his body. Yeah. He blew his own head off. They found his body. Sorry if we're going to get graphic here, people. But blew his own head off. And then Euronymous finds the body and picks up pieces of the skull and saves them.
Yep.
Then there's rumors that he made like stew or something with it, but most people think...
Well, not only that, he took a picture of it and then they used it on the front of their next album.
Right. Like, here's our singer.
And it was just, here's our singer, and he just blew his head off, and, you know, that's metal.
Black metal. That book is just so disturbing, because, you know, like, I was totally into the music at the time. I didn't really, you know, I heard, like, those things, but I think, you know, like, the story with, like, Ozzy biting the head off the bat, and all of these things, you just assume that they're, like, legend.
Yes.
And that kind of makes it cool and interesting, but then, like, as an adult reading the book and going, oh no, this is real. And these people are mentally disturbed. A lot of, especially Varg Vikernes. The guy is, and I don't really care if I pronounce his name right, because he's an asshole and a Nazi, but that's probably the part about the book that terrified me the most, is like how a good percentage of those bands slipped into fascism and Nazism.
They became almost what they hated, because they were so, you know, pissed off that a lot of the, you know, Christian crusades came through and basically tore off, you know, all their beliefs. I mean, they would go up on a hill and worship the Father, you know, under the sun. And then all of a sudden a church was being built there and they were mad. And so they just started burning the churches down.
And then they become the same thing. They become like these proto-fascists, where it's like what you're fighting against is essentially like a fascist ideology of, you know, replacing one church with another, like dominance of wasn't really the Catholic Church, but the Christian Church. I think it was probably the Lutheran Church probably coming out of Germany. But
it was all just equally warfare at that point. Who's right? Who's wrong? Just pointing fingers.
Until they start talking about like, we were a pagan country, a non-Christian country. We're taken over by the Christians.
Right.
And we just want to reclaim our heritage. Sounds like a really good story. Right. And you're like, okay, I can understand wanting to feel that way. But then the way they go with it, you're like, okay, never mind.
Might have not have been the best approach.
Well, it makes it seem like bullshit. You know, it's like, oh, you know, it's like, I want to be a Nazi, but my excuse to be a Nazi is this story over here.
And they were young. I think they were like 17 or something like that. And if you're in that part of the world and you murder someone, you only do what, 13, 14 years? That's it. You're out.
Right.
They don't do life like America. You get life, you know?
I'm trying to see how old Euronymous was when he died. 84 was a ban. He died in 93, 25. So he, I think he was older than the others. But yeah, I think
you're right.
Too, where Varg walks in and shoots him in the hallway. And then there's this argument about, it was because he was a communist. It was because he was a homosexual. It was because it was over music. It was over money. There's like 30 different stories that he told about why he did it.
Yeah. And it's, who can you believe? What do you believe at that point?
Definitely not Varg Vikernes.
Yeah. There's so many documentaries out there.
Well, there's that movie coming out with Macaulay Culkin's brother, Kieran Culkin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's called Lords of Chaos, but I mean, it's only a small percentage of the book, obviously.
And we'll see how they follow it.
Well, from what I saw, it looks like, I don't know if you saw the Netflix biopic of Motley Crue recently that they made.
I did not.
So basically, it's humorous. It's funny. And it's got like, they both have that same tone where it's like sarcastic. So I don't think that, I could be wrong. They might be using like the parts of comedy that are in the commercial in the Lords of Chaos movie to balance out maybe some of the darker elements. But it seems like they're not fully taking it seriously, which could be good.
It could, yeah. And I mean, when I started getting into black metal, I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me is they didn't believe in a god. So what they believed is when you feel that you've reached your peak in life, you take your own life. And that's it. You don't wait for God. You don't wait for anything like that.
Right.
So like the lead singer Dissection, I mean, he did, you know, he was right there when the murders took place and he did some time. And when he got out, he was touring the world and America would not allow him in. And I had tickets. This was like 2006.
Right.
And I had tickets to go see him. I was stoked. I wanted to see Dissection and then the lead singer, John, the rumor has it is that America would not let him in because, you know, of his record. So he took his own life. And then when they interview his band, they were basically saying, well, yeah, of course he did. He reached his peak. He was good. And they refunded the tickets because of what he did.
And then that's once again, the scenario of who do you believe?
Who do you believe? Yeah.
What's the truth? Then that's the thing about these, you know, as I think in music of all sorts, you know, even referencing what I said earlier about Ozzy and all that, like it's so hard to tell the story from the reality because it gets passed, you know, even with the internet, things are still passed word of mouth, you know, like this guy said it on this forum and then and then this guy said it on Reddit, but he changed it a little bit and, you know, it's all still a game of telephone. So you just never know.
Absolutely.
Begs the question, how did you get into black metal?
So I actually heard, first of all, I started playing guitar at a young age and I loved Metallica. And that was kind of like my gateway. And one of my good friends, introduced me to At the Gates. And Slaughter of the Soul was like number one metal album. And I never heard anything like this. And that whole album, I mean, you could listen front to back. It's great. And then I heard Dissection. And that's when I started to dig into that world. And Emperor. And all those bands were just underground. I mean, we all knew Slayer. We all knew Cannibal Corpse. And, you know, those kind of bands were becoming more mainstream. But this was different to me. This was something I had never heard before. And what they were singing about was dark.
Right.
And I was really attracted to that. I was attracted to the darkness. And so I just kind of dove right in. And then I started playing it myself. And I was really influenced by Dissection. And I was really influenced by, you know, the whole Riot Girl scene too. Because the whole Riot Girl with, you know, you had Bikini Kill and L7. And of course, you know, we have Nirvana Hole. And it was something for me where I'm looking up at these women and I'm like, well, shit, they're going out there all punk rock, not giving a fuck. And basically I just felt, well, why don't I take that up just another step and play metal? And that's basically how I got into it.
I can imagine, like, even me, like as a boy, Kathleen Hanna was like the shit.
Because she
just
amazing.
Didn't give a fuck about anything.
Oh no.
But she cared.
And, well, she hated men. She would be up there on stage and she would tell all the boys just to get back, let all the girls up at the front. She would push them, moon them, flash them.
She was the shit. Was, I mean, crazy. She still is.
Yeah, she's totally the shit. I love her.
We were privileged. I think maybe people that are younger now listening to whatever music they're listening to now feel that way. But I feel like we were privileged in the 90s with some pretty crazy music.
Absolutely.
I mean, most people will just point to hip hop and the grunge. But then when you take in like black metal, death metal, all of these other scenes that were going on at the same time, Riot Girl, that's a lot of music pushing boundaries that had never been pushed before.
Not to mention we had all the influences of everything before that.
Right.
I mean, exactly. You can go from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. We had all that. 80s to influence. It was a whole mixture.
There was a period of time where like there was a triad of bands, and it was like everybody, it was surprising because we went from like MC Hammer and not Backstreet Boys, but
right.
What the hell was that other
band? And Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, Vanilla Ice, MC Hammer. What the hell was that boy?
Marky Mark.
Yeah. What was his brother's group? Donnie Wahlberg.
Oh, New Kids on the Block.
Yes. There we go. We went from that to Nirvana. Well, we went from that to hair metal to Nirvana. Hair metal was like the gateway drug.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, you know, it was like the mainstream was Nirvana, Metallica, and Guns N' Roses. Those were like three gods of that. You know, there were a bunch of other bands, but those three were like the top of the heap. And like 5 years before, that type of music was underground. That was, nowhere to be heard on radio. And it's like, so for me, like the gateway was hair metal. Metallica. I went from hair metal to Metallica. And then from Metallica, then we started listening to like Type O Negative and stuff like that. Then we got into death metal.
Right. Depeche Mode.
Yep. And then somebody played me To Eve, The Art of Witchcraft by Cradle of Filth. And I was like, what the hell is that? And I didn't like it at first, but it was like in my head. Like there's that organ solo. And I was like, what? I couldn't get it out of my head. And so then I'm like, yeah, you got to put that on tape for me. So then I had that one song.
That's what I love about music. You can just be sitting there and all of a sudden, like one song will just change you. It changes, like it almost feels like your whole direction.
Oh, totally.
And that's pretty powerful to have that influence over you or someone else.
Well, it's because it's insidious in the sense that, you know, like music, sometimes it bypasses like our thought process, right? It goes right into the deeper part of our brain and into like our emotions. So like it bypasses so many filters. And then once it's in there, you're like, oh, this is powerful. Why is it powerful? Because it's already in me. It's really
it's making sense.
Yeah, you like that song. Like for me, like because I had grown up in a fairly religious household. So like that was like dangerous. That was scary, which was part of the appeal, right? So I would only allow myself, like, I just listened to this song, just this song. And then it would be like, I got to hear the other songs on the album. And then it was the album, and then it was Emperor, and then it was just floodgates from there. Yeah, when I was actually today, I dug through my old, you remember those big booklets where you can put all the CDs in without the cases?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think I still have one.
I have like four of those out in the garage that I haven't looked at in forever, which every time I open.
Yeah, same here.
Makes me embarrassed how much money I spent on a medium that I don't even look at anymore. But I go out there and I found the first Lords album and re-listened that today. And then while I was flipping through there, I saw Dissection and everything. I'm like, oh, there's so many of these metal albums in here I haven't heard in so long.
It's funny that you mentioned the Lords album. I don't even own one myself.
That's usually the way it works, right?
You're like, how does that happen?
You're more concerned with getting other people to buy it at the time, right? You're not trying to preserve it.
Right. I didn't think about it.
Well, I know like there was a period of time, I don't know if it's still true, there was a period of time where Eric and the guys in Strata didn't have some of the Downside stuff that they made. Like, we don't have any of our own. Like, there was a couple of CDs that they printed. They're like, we don't have it.
So there was only like 1,000 that we printed for The End to Begin and Blood of Time. And that was it. That's the only ones that are circulating out there, 1,000.
I have one. Just the first one. I never got to the second one.
Right.
Back in the Gaslighter days.
That's right.
Seems like a long time ago for me. I think it's fascinating too, if somebody like popped onto your Instagram right now and saw the contrast in like, you know, like you're, they wouldn't look at you and go, oh yeah, she used to be in a black metal band. I love that.
Oh, it's night and day. I mean, people do not know I play music or I did. And, you know, cause it was something where, you know, you're in a band and you're part of this family.
Right.
And so when I had, you know, I had to look for something else as an outlet, and modeling just became that outlet. And I always wanted to be a model since I was young. I loved taking pictures, and music was kind of that, was both. You know, you take band pictures, you're on stage, you're playing music, you're sharing your soul. And what influences you. But then, you know, you're also wanting to tour the world and see the world. And that's kind of the what I wanted. I wanted all of it. I wanted my cake and eat it too, right?
That's what we all want.
And so, well, yeah, I'm guilty. But then it's like when I started modeling, I was like, well, hey, I could create pictures. I could create like scenarios that can... It can be dark if I want, or it can be bright and smiley and beautiful. So I just started using that. And only most recently have I thought about getting back into music again and picking up the guitar and playing and kind of getting back to my roots, as I should say, because I miss it. There's nothing like it.
Connected, because for the people listening, your Lamb has mentioned that there's somebody that he was talking to about making music with, that's you, for the people who've heard
it. Right.
So they kind of have heard of you. They didn't know they'd heard of you.
Right. And that's what's so interesting, because here I am, I'm just showing up to a Campbell coffee shop and I'm just enjoying, you know, some coffee, morning breakfast, and I'm on my phone, I'm networking, and Lamb walks up to me. He's like, gosh, you look so familiar. And we're trying to place it, like, where have we met before? And so then when he's like realizing, like, hey, did you you used to be in a band? I'm like, yeah, Lords of the Manor. I used to play with, well, they were called Downside at the time. And he started laughing. He goes, oh my gosh, I haven't heard anyone say that name in a while. I go, well, that's how far back I go.
Back to and the clown cycle days.
Oh my gosh. It was so good because he remembers me sitting there with Ryan Hernandez and Adrian and Eric Victorino. We're just talking after a show. And so I told him, I wish I could tap into your brain and see that.
It is kind of weird.
That memory.
Because I was around those days too. I didn't know you then and I didn't know Lamb. But like I was with the guys all the time, but well, I shouldn't say all the time. I would go over and watch them play and then I would go back to the bar across the street.
Nice.
I didn't do much of the lobby hanging out. I was a little bit older, so I was like, nah. I'm old enough to go to the bar, so I'm gonna go in the bar.
It just kind of shows how small the world is and how close it is. I mean, everyone knows everyone. Facebook kind of put that in perspective.
Right.
Oh, you have a mutual friend. And it's like, huh. Kind of makes you think.
Well, also, like, you guys had to have played a couple of shows with Delta, right?
Yeah.
So Tom's the other co-host on this show, and he was a guitar player in Delta. So there's another strange connection.
Yeah. It's San Jose, it's a big city, but it's not. And
especially Campbell.
When our band went out to Los Angeles, I mean, it was huge and it was different than playing here. I felt like there was more connection here. People wanted to come together. They wanted to build a scene. And I didn't find that when we had, transferred out to Los Angeles and tried playing out there. It just felt very, almost like alone. You get up on stage, you do your thing, and that's it. And there was no real connection there. And I've always wanted to build and be a part of a scene that, takes over the world, so to speak.
Was that moving to LA, was that the beginning of the end of the band then? Is that how the band ended or what?
Yeah, absolutely. When we had moved out there, we were probably only out there for 6 months. And sadly, my story is really sad because our bass player was having problems. He was having problems being noticed. While we're in San Jose, we're getting on KSJO and everyone remembers Sloppy Joe. And so our song's getting played on the radio. And so our bass player would, he'd go into a store, he'd go into a restaurant and someone would be like, hey man, you're the bass player, Lords of the Manor. And he didn't like it. He actually didn't like the attention. It bothered him. He wanted to be left alone. And that was something I never expected. Like, you don't know how you're going to react.
Right.
When you start to take off a little bit here. And everyone's different. And so maybe this is something that happens a lot, maybe not. But he, I love the attention. I liked hanging out with my fans. I liked taking pictures with them. I liked talking with them. They wanted to hear, who influenced me as a guitar player. And I loved it. But for my bass player, he didn't. And he started to go into this like dark hole of kind of removing himself emotionally and mentally from us. And he started using drugs and using heroin and hiding it from us. So he would show up to band practice and he's like pale white. We're trying to take band photos and we're like, dude, what's up? What's wrong? What's wrong with him? And so then when we, moved out to Los Angeles, he was thanking us and telling us like, thank you so much. Because this is kind of like a rehab for me and I have no access. And so we felt like things were, lifting up. And unfortunately, it wasn't. It was like my birthday. And we're all partying. We're having a good time. And we decided to do this unfortunately, this photo shoot at 8 a.m. in the morning. Like, what band wakes up at 8 a.m. after partying all night to go do a photo shoot? Like, come on. It was hell on earth. So, you know, we wake up, and unfortunately, he decided to use, and he took a hot dose, and he had passed away. And so we had found him, and the sad part is we walk into the room and we're like, dude, Derek, come on, man. Like, wake up. And, he's not waking up. And so then, let's play Cannibal Corpse. So we played Cannibal Corpse, blasting that music. And then he just wasn't waking up. And that's when we realized it was over. So our story was really sad, but we never told anybody. I mean, people knew, but they, you know, we just kind of, it was so heartbreaking that we didn't announce anything really. I mean, people knew word of mouth and, you know, close friends and people who came out, but that was the end of Lords of Manor for us.
Wow. It's a brutal.
Yeah. Thing. So it was brutal. And so you can see why I didn't play music for a really long time, because it was very, very painful.
Yeah. That's an association that's hard to get over.
It's really hard to get over. And I know that a lot of other band members go through that. You know, I mean, half the stories out there, you know, they're losing a band member. And so it took a long time for me to come around and start thinking about creating again, a really long time. And that's where like modeling became such a happy point for me, because I had no association with any of that. It was just freedom. It was becoming like, okay, here's a designer. They want to design for someone, design for the world and how they're going to look. You know, you think about the Renaissance time, someone was designing all that.
Right.
It's amazing. Corsets and badass slips. And so I wanted to kind of be a part of something again, but I didn't know what that was going to be. And so when I found modeling by accident, it just kind of took off. And so that's where my avenues have been so far.
Do you still talk to anybody from Lords?
Yeah, my lead singer is my best friend, and we talk every week.
I haven't seen Jot in forever. How is he?
I love Jot. He moved out to Texas, actually. He bought the first manor, in fact.
Are him and Angie still married?
Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
And they're doing great out there. And so he actually invited me out to come see the first manor, because our Lords of the Manor was like this dream of, we weren't going to really tour the world. We actually wanted to build a castle, Lords of the Manor. An actual manor. Everyone would come to the manor. We would have a stage there, and we would just have bands come through and play, and we would just headline, or whoever headline, for that night, and we just party it up. And it was basically going to be like a hotel where people could stay there at the event, and then we would just play shows and people just be coming in and out, having something either every night or every weekend. We weren't really sure what we wanted to do, but that was a dream, that was the vision, that was a whole part of the name.
That explains, I was looking at the booklet, that explains something that you have on the booklet here. I don't know if you remember what you put on the back.
Yeah.
Let's call us at the manor. Harass
us. That's right. Yeah, totally right.
You were practicing for that already.
Oh, we wanted it. We were asking for it.
Oh, you guys actually put your personal phone numbers on here too.
Which we did. We put our phone numbers there. We wanted to have, we wanted phone calls.
That was a different world though too, right? It wasn't that scary to do that then.
No, not at all.
Now it's like,
well, I guess it's the same as social media in a sense, you know, it's like someone could just send a message directly. You could choose to answer it or not.
You think, having been in a band at a time when social media was, well, I don't want to say non-existent, because I think MySpace was around, but it wasn't really much help. Do you think that social media giving bands access to fans as it does in the long run is a help? Or do you think that we've lost something?
Well, I mean, like when you look at how that affects society, it can almost be unhealthy because we're on our phones or we're on social media, our sleep patterns, some people have anxiety, depression, just spending too much time on social media. And I think it enhances, of course, if you're trying to run, you know, a business, you know, you could think of a music as a business, bands, anyone who's trying to promote themselves. So social media kind of affects the way we perceive, or a customer would perceive, a business brand.
Right.
And I think it enhances the experience of sharing information. People want, you know, as a fan, I want to know what's going on with someone that's influencing me. Right. I want to know everything about them. And so, and I want to have a personal connection, and social media kind of gives that. You can go to that person's site and be like, oh wow, they're here right now. They're, you know, on vacation, or they're, you know, they're going to be coming to town soon, or they're working on this project, this new movie coming out. People like to be a part of that. They want to know the secrets, the ins and outs. So I think that's great as far as, you know, that kind of influence. But when I think about MySpace, that, you know, that was the start of it all. And I feel like with Facebook, and Facebook kind of opened up more of a, almost like a politics avenue, because I kind of felt like now with social media, politics are, you know, they're now more accountable and accessible for like voters. So I feel like that's more like Facebook is more like the family. Facebook is more, you know, kind of showing more politics, where MySpace is more for yourself, for music, for the artist.
Yeah,
that's how I kind of feel and look at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't open. I mean, it was open to the general public, but the general public, for the most part, wasn't using it. It was mostly people our age. Well, not our age now. Mostly people when we were younger.
You're right. No, I see. Right. And, I do feel that 20. not too many parents are really on Instagram. They're on Facebook. And a lot of the younger generation, they are getting out of Facebook. A lot of them are deleting it. And they don't want to be a part of it. They like the Instagram. They like the stories. They like everything on there.
See, I wonder also, you know, like going back to what we were saying about, you want to know what's going on with the artist. Do you think that there's a line there where, you know, because I think about, maybe I should give you a little background on where I'm coming from. When I think about that era and before, you know, pre-social media, there was a mystique about bands and celebrities in general, because we only had access to so much information, right? You know, like if they did an interview in a magazine, you know, you go get the magazine and you read the interview, and then you just devour like that little bit of that interview. And if you know you're a super fan, you're mining it for information. Okay, I would do this. Okay, they like this album, and this album. I need to listen to those albums. And I feel like because we have so much access on social media, maybe not in every case because nothing's ever 100%, but a lot of times it goes over that line to where you're getting too much information, to where you're not as interested. It becomes, you know, like you're, it's almost like you become ungrateful. You're like, oh, here's a wealth of information. I don't care anymore. But if it was just that one interview here, and then, you know, the liner notes and the album and this, then you're totally obsessed. So I wonder where the line between those two is, and, you know, like where you're just giving just enough. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's where I feel like it comes down to the artist, because social media, like Instagram per se, has given it back to the people. So I no longer, as a model, have to go through an agency and have them you know, promote me. I could promote myself.
And that's a great
point. So now that everyone is basically promoting themselves, that's where they have to either pull in the reins or not and monitor themselves. And okay, I'm just going to, you know, give them crumbs right now, because we have full control now. I don't have to listen to someone say, hey, you're not tall enough. You can't, you know, you can't model because you're not this size. You're not this shape. It's changing. It's starting to be back in arc, the people's control.
That's a really
good point. Nice. Really nice brings that up to have it.
I've talked about the social media thing, and that's the first time that's come up, the decimation of the gatekeepers. Because it definitely was, you know, like before for music, the hard part about local bands was your whole goal pretty much was to get signed, because you knew that you can only get so large as a local band because that's the reach you had. There was no other way.
And you're at their mercy.
And that's the only
thing. And where they're going to promote you.
That's the only thing I fear about, like Instagram, you know, Instagram being owned by Facebook, these large corporations owning, you know, these gateways. You know, there's no gatekeepers, but there are gateways, and they own the gateways. You know, like when people got pissed off because Instagram changed the algorithm and it screwed a lot of like independent artists, like they weren't getting their pieces, weren't showing up in people's feeds anymore. That's a little scary too, because it seems like there aren't any gatekeepers, but they're just behind the scenes more, right? Like they can.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely being monitored. What you like shows up more.
Like there's a lot of models that have phone numbers, booking phone numbers in their Instagram. You know, like if they change a rule tomorrow where they're like, no more phone numbers, they could screw over a lot of people really quickly, right?
Yeah, they could, absolutely.
It's a little terrifying, but I mean, what's the alternative? There's no such thing as, you know, like a non-corporately owned social media.
And I feel like where there's a will, there's a way.
Maybe we can make a co-op one where all of the users own it. Right. Theoretically possible. And just who wants to do it? I don't know. What's in it for them?
It's just interesting how, you know, a lot has changed, even with magazines. And I've been getting published in magazines, but it's kind of like a lot of things are going more in the direction of being online. I still like to hold a magazine.
Right. Yeah, there's something different. Like I have the Apple News where I get the magazines in the Apple News. And that's nice because I have access to magazines I wouldn't actually buy, where I just want to read one thing in it. But the magazines that I really enjoy, yeah, I want to hold it, because I'm sorry, there's no digital screen that looks as good as a photo on print.
Right.
And even like the, you know, like People magazine, you know, they're not the highest quality pages and stuff like that, but even those magazines look better than a screen.
I don't like reading a screen. I mean, I'm not a huge fan. Like they have the Kindles and everything, and I'd rather hold a book.
You know, I have a huge internal problem with that, because with myself, because I do prefer reading books, but I have so many books and I acquire so many books that I can't like literally keep that many books. So I had to like train myself to start reading ebooks. And what I do now is like, I only buy books in physical form if I can't get them in digital, just because I have, like, if I look to my right here, I have 900 books on shelves right here.
Oh, wow. That is a lot.
So, you know, and I'm actually trying to get rid of some. I'm trying to digitize some of it because it's just too much. But that's my problem, where it's like, yeah, I prefer books, but if I had all the books that I own in paper, I would live inside of a house made out of books. Which, as you can imagine, is not the best on 4th of July, because it's just one big fire hazard to have a house made out of
books. I'm sure.
All those years of books gone in one night.
Well, and you know, speaking of you know, fireworks and 4th of July, I just got back from Shasta Lake. And what was interesting to me was the whole time I was out there, I did not have any access to the internet, no phone, no nothing. And it was really nice to unplug and just let go. And as soon as I got back into town, it was like ding, 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 ding. And I was almost shaking. I was like dreading looking at my phone because I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I got to get back to all these messages. I got to get, you know, I got to answer this and do that. And it felt like a job, like I was getting back to work.
It is a job.
And I kind of wonder, that's exactly how it felt.
It's a job we all take on and we get no pay for it.
Right.
It's like the worst fucking job in the world.
Yeah. So we're
you're available 24/7. You don't get paid.
Right.
You can't escape it. I think as I've...
And we're addicted to it.
Totally addicted to it. You know, you get your pulse jumps up after you... Like when I do these, I have the computer screen in front of me. I try to turn away from the computer screen because if I stare at this thing for like 2 hours, by the end of these things, my heart rate is like 20 beats higher just from staring at the screen.
Right. I mean, have you heard that likes on Instagram, or if you have a like, it's like that of doing a line of cocaine?
Yeah. It's
that kind of endorphin being released.
And they said they've experimented with, there's all these things they were saying they've experimented with delaying people's likes showing up to like get them mm-hmm. more addicted to the app, where it's like, oh, if they got the like that moment, then they wouldn't get the same rush. So we're going to wait and then give it to them in 2 minutes when they close the app, and then they'll see the notification come back into the app, and then the rush will be even bigger, which is
wow.
Gnarly, right? How much research they've put into this shit, or like you have to pull down to refresh because it reminds you of a slot machine. All of this stuff. And that's the repulsive side of social media that really bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that we're all being manipulated in some way, but we're all kind of signing on for it as well.
And absolutely, we're signing on.
About, I think it was about 4 months ago, I deleted all of my social media. I now have, well, I shouldn't say I have, Lam, Tom, and I have an account for this show, but we only use it for the show. And when I post from outside the app, and we don't follow anybody. I just can't get hooked back into that because in the months since then, like the amount of sanity that has come back to me, not that I felt like I was insane before, but like being relieved of it, I realized, like you were saying, the level of that I was operating at was insane. Where it's like, oh,
it's constant.
I was dipping into it. You know, like you don't even realize how many times you dip into it. And, you know, there's all the tricks of like, oh, don't put it on your phone and all this stuff. But you fall back for it, you know, because you're like, well, that's a pain in the ass. Anything that's a pain in the ass. You know, you're like, I don't want to go on my computer and look at that shit. Even though like going back to MySpace, that's the only
way. Actually, no, I don't. Well, and that's right. We were on our computers, but you're right. I don't, if I had to log into a computer to look at Facebook and Instagram, I would never do it.
Right.
It's so convenient with the app being on my phone.
Yep. But that's the thing was, you know, I thought that was, MySpace is a really interesting topic in and of itself, because like it was technically not the first social media, but it was the first big one. It was the first one that most people that you knew were on. And it was so, but at the same time, it's so different than every form. You know, like you had to go on a computer. There was no mobile. We didn't have, you know, we had Snake on our cell phones. That was about it. You know, there was no mobile browser. So like, and it was, there was no feed. You know, there was the bulletins or whatever. But so you had to go to each person individually and go, okay, what's up with this person? And look at their page.
Yeah, you had to literally wonder, how are they doing?
Yeah.
Let's go check it out.
And I have to admit, I kind of miss that purposefulness.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a passiveness to like current social media where it's like, oh, I found out what that person's doing. Doesn't mean I actually wanted to know. So like you don't really absorb. But when you're actually making a choice to go look at something from somebody, you're going to remember that because you're choosing to engage with it. And it felt like it was more rewarding to me. You know, I could just be, you know, the way older people talk about like the golden age of television. I could just be
right
glossing over the past and making it better than it was, but it seemed like it was, I don't know, it seemed like it was more fun.
Well, yeah, and you got to make your page, you put up like a you know, a back wall to it, and you had music playing.
All the flash stuff.
Yeah. I mean, people would go all out and just deck out their MySpace, and I digged it. I thought it was great.
Was it the top 5 or the top 10? I can't remember.
I think it was like...
Or top 4?
Might have been top 5.
For anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, when you had a MySpace, you had, you know, say you had 50 friends. Nobody had like 300 friends then, but you had like 50 friends.
Right.
You'd pick like a top group, and then those were like, I think they just showed up at the top of your page when you signed in so that you could go check them out first. But then when people went to look at your page, they could see who your top people were. So it was like this, probably the first intrusion of like social media guilt. It was like, why am I not in your top five?
Yeah, how come I'm not top five?
Yeah, like if you don't have your girlfriend in your top five.
Adding more and more. Yeah, you're in trouble then.
Maybe that's why I can't remember the number. Maybe it was like 5 and then it was like, okay, fine, you can have 10.
I think they did 5, 8, and 10. I think that's how it went. Yeah.
I think technically it still exists too on MySpace.
And was it Tom for Facebook?
The unchanging photo in the white t-shirt waving.
I know. It's so funny.
All you people too young to have experienced MySpace, you really missed something. It wasn't very long either.
It's a ghost town now.
It was maybe like what? Like a year? Or was it? It wasn't very long. Maybe it was longer. I'm not sure. It felt like it was like...
I felt like after 2008, when the economy crashed, like everything changed. And that's when MySpace pretty much changed.
Yeah, because it was like MySpace, and then it was like, I remember, actually, technically, I signed up for Friendster first, because everybody's like, check this thing out, Friendster. I'm like, what's that? I signed up, and literally the next day, everybody's like, never mind, we're going to MySpace. I'm like, what the hell is that? So now I jump over that, and then I felt like it wasn't very long, like maybe a year, maybe two, if I stretch it, and then it was on to Facebook, and then Twitter was like...
That's right.
Right after, and it was weird to have Facebook and Twitter at first, because you're like, wait, both? Why do we need both?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
It was an interesting. Why did I type in Facebook? I was trying to look up the history of MySpace, and I typed in Facebook. Bastards.
Well, what's funny? There's like a running joke of how many apps do you need to just talk to the same people? We got Snapchat, Instagram, you know, Facebook.
it makes a little bit more sense, in the sense that there are a lot of people leaving certain services or only on certain ones. But for a while there, it was literally, yeah, like, oh, did you see my post on MySpace? No, not MySpace. On Facebook? No, but I saw the repost of it over on your Twitter, you know, because... Right. We were posting the same shit in 3 different places or 4 different places to the same people. That's what you call excess.
Do you know about Marco Polo?
The game?
No, the app.
No, what's that?
So you download Marco Polo, and basically you do a recording where you're talking to your friend. So if they live far or whatnot, you just, you know, do a little selfie, start pushing record, and you just talk to them like, hey man, how's it going? I've been doing this, I've been doing that. And then they send a video back to you in response.
Almost?
Pretty much. Yeah. And they call it Marco Polo.
Interesting. I know that there was a guy, oh shit, I don't remember who it was, a couple of years ago. I think it was like one of these, like, you know, people that try to tell you how the best, coolest ways to use your social media account, and then they get famous for telling you how to do it. And he was replying to people. Oh, you know who I think it was? Gary Vaynerchuk. I don't know if you know who that is.
No.
When people would send him something on Twitter, he would reply with a video instead of replying. Oh, really? You know, like, oh, thanks. He just like record a video and be like, hey, thanks, I really appreciate that. Boom. And send it back. So like, in a way,
that's a lot of work.
It was a predecessor to Marco Polo, maybe, in a way, right?
It could be.
See, that's how fast this shit happens, because I thought TikTok was like the new thing, but now it's already jumped to Marco Polo.
Yeah.
I can't find... I'm really trying to find the year that it took a shit, that MySpace took a shit. I'm guessing
it's 2008, because I just feel...
That sounds about that right.
That was a crossover. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Oh, here we go. Okay. On November 1st, 2007, MySpace and Bebo joined. Okay. So it's saying all of a sudden all these other social medias opened. Then you had Orkut and Facebook. Yeah, I think you're right. It looks like late 2007, 2008. Good call.
Wow. There you go.
You could be a tech reporter.
I love it. Sign me up. Do I get paid?
Well, nobody gets paid to do writing anymore.
it's
the shit. I was just explaining that to somebody today. There's this publication that maybe I was going to write for. And then I was changed my mind like a week later. And the person was like, why did you change your mind? I'm like, because the pay is not that good. They're like, what's the pay? And then I explained it. And they're like, I was like, it's $300 an article. Well, that's good. It's like, no, not really. Because you're putting
you can't live here off that.
And you're putting like 10, 12 hours into an article. Like, that's not very much money an hour when it comes to nobody pays, you know. I don't know, like, for modeling, do you have trouble with like getting the, you know, like having to argue about rates with people and stuff because everybody wants shit for cheap now?
Oh, yeah. And it's like you go back and forth too, because sometimes it's like the designer's paying the photographer, so the photographer finds the model. And then it's like, okay, well, let's say the model doesn't know the designer. They don't know that they're paying the photographer. The photographer normally pays the model. And so sometimes it's like, hey, I know you're getting paid. Like, you know, help me out. You know, you don't got a picture without the model. So it's really when you start to become more in demand that you pay your dues. So when I started out, they call it trade for photo. And,
TFP? I saw that somewhere.
Right.
Oh, maybe it was on your
TFP.
Maybe it's on yours. No TFP.
It is on mine. Yeah. So okay. I put no more because I don't want to deal with that anymore. I've paid my dues. I've done my share. So basically, you are supposed to, in trade, get the photo. But what the problem is, when you start out and they're taking pictures of you, you used to get a print, high resolution. So now they're sending it to you through email. And I'm going back into maybe a few years back and I'm trying to bring up the photo. I'm like, this isn't even high resolution. I can't print this.
Oh, fuck.
And so when you upload it onto Facebook, it totally distorts it. So if you were to try to take one of my photos, save it, print it, it's not going to look right. The only way it can look right is if you go directly to the photographer and say, hey, can I get a copy of the high resolution of Julie Matthews? Oh, yeah, let me bring it up. Let me send it to you. And then you could print it. So if you are starting out as a model and it's trade for photo, make sure to get high resolution, whether they send it through a Dropbox, some type of link, because I didn't really do that. And a lot of my stuff was just, you know, it was saved on the computer, but the resolution is not quality. And so, you know, it wasn't until maybe after I started modeling for designers. My first designer I modeled for was West Coast Leather. And, you know, he takes care of, you know, who models for him and photographers. And, then I went over to, you know, that opened up the door to model for a lot more other photographers and designers and things like that. So, but yeah, I mean, it's not something where I can make, you know, real money out of it. And, you know, everyone kind of has a running joke, like, well, none of us are in it for the money.
It's like the music business until you get famous, right?
Yeah, exactly. You really pay your dues, you know. It's like in music, you play all the dive bars and, you know, work your way up. And but with modeling, it's a little bit different. You know, you do a lot of fashion shows. A lot of fashion shows are not paid. And that kind of gets you out there. It's networking. And I love it. I mean, I started out modeling not to get paid. I really started out because it was a passion of mine. I just wanted an outlet, something that, you know, I can create with someone. Because when you speak with a photographer, it's like, hey, what kind of photo shoot do you want to do? And you kind of go back and forth and come up with ideas. It's like writing a song. And then you basically have the foundation. All right, let's create. And you get in the room and you just create. You just have fun. I mean, you were mentioning how you had a bunch of books and I just started thinking photo shoot.
Oh, yeah.
I started imagining myself there in walls of books, reading a book, you know, wearing a designer's outfit. I mean, that's where my mind goes.
Piecing it together. It's like wardrobe for, you know, like films and stuff like that too, right? You know, it's
absolutely more
part of your brain.
Yeah.
Putting together the scenes. You know what I'm curious about is maybe it's just because it's never been my experience to be around for this, but like, is it weird, at least when you're starting out, you know, like there's a lot of shots that you've done that you're in either a bathing suit or in underwear. Is that weird at first? Is that uncomfortable at first? Or were you just like naturally not, did you like naturally not think about it?
Well, yeah. So when I first started, it was like no semi-nude, no nudity, nothing of it. And so, you know, it's like bikini was as far as I would go. And what helped me modeling is I got really comfortable with my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of looked at it as a breakthrough that now I could be, you know, in front of the camera and be confident and feel sexy and feel like, okay, you know, I like pictures like this. And it was a gradual type of, I don't know, just evolving into what I think is art. Because so many, you know, famous painters have painted, you know, figure modeling and things like that. And I started getting into that. I started getting into figure modeling and portrait modeling, and I have a lot of respect for it. And so I look at photography the same way, just as someone painting me. I think it's just as beautiful to capture. And I started modeling for a Darkest Fox,
mm-hmm.
and high fashion lingerie. And I love their line. And once I started modeling for them, it just really took off. And I was completely comfortable with my body at that point. But it can be a little awkward because when you start out and you are not comfortable with nudity, mm-hmm. I mean, you'll get into a room and a photographer will be like, oh, okay, now why don't you take your shirt off? And you're like, why?
Oh, yeah, that would be weird.
Why would I take my shirt off? I'm modeling. I'm supposed to be modeling clothes. Why am I modeling my birthday suit? See, it has to be discussed. I mean, a lot of times, if you're going into it, like, hey, like I was kind of mentioning before, when you're working with a photographer, you think, okay, hey, I would like to work with you. Okay, awesome. What do you want to do? You start sharing, kind of like from Pinterest, you start sharing ideas. Oh, what if we did something like this? And, you know, maybe it's like a sheet drape, you know, silk, like over the body, and it's out in the woods and it's all artistic and high fashion or whatnot. And that's great. And that's fine. If you're going into it like that. But if I show up to a photo shoot and I'm supposed to be wearing jeans and a t-shirt or shorts or modeling, I don't know, makeup and hair, and then they say, okay, now take your shirt off. I mean, that's not what I signed up for. And so you can see that becomes pretty awkward.
Yeah, that's kind of catchy. I mean, do you take people with you?
Yeah, and I've had to say no. I mean, it's just like, well, no, I'm not comfortable doing that, or that's not what I signed up for.
Yeah, because I can imagine how there's going to be at least a small percentage of people out there just like waiting to manipulate people in situations.
Well, yeah. So when I first started modeling, so this is how I got into it. My girlfriend of mine, we've gone to school forever and together and been through so much together. And so she's my best friend, and she hits me up and she's like, "Hey, I'm looking for a designer. I have an idea for, and I need to find someone that can create it." And so we drive up to San Francisco and it's raining. It's just miserable outside. And we get there and we see a sign-in sheet. So we start signing in, and this gentleman comes up to us, approaches us and says, "Hey, are you here for the model casting?" And we're like looking at each other, like, what is he talking about? And we're like, "No, we're here for like the tech fashion networking event." And this gentleman's like, "No, that's not until next Wednesday." And we're thinking, oh my God, we drove all the way here through the rain. Are you kidding me? And, you know, for those who are listening, you know, it's an hour away where we're driving. So he's like, "Well, why don't you come in and, you know, why don't you walk for us and try out and just have fun?" So I was like, "All right, hell yeah, let's do it." So when I was auditioning and walking back, he had me do like the whole catwalk thing. And I was walking back and he goes, "Okay, all right. You can do editorial, you can do fashion, you could do makeup, hair, you can model, you know, foot modeling, hand modeling, but you'll never do runway. You're not tall enough." And I was like, "Okay, that's fine." And he said, "I'll set you up with two of my photographers and they'll take you out because you need to start building your portfolio." And I thought, okay. And to kind of speed up on that story, it's funny when someone says, "Oh, you'll never do," like what he said, "you'll never do runway." I ended up at New York Fashion Week 2018. So it's like, never listen. Like, I mean, I was just happy that he was setting me up with photographers, but it's just so funny how someone can say that one thing. And I mean, what does anyone really know what anyone's capable of doing?
Right. Everybody thinks that the little experience that they have, which even people who have a lot is still a little, that's like to know everything, you know, like, oh no, right. Can't do that. How do I know? I've been a photographer for 15 years. So what?
Right.
The fuck's that mean? That's your experience.
Exactly. And, you know, I kind of felt like 3 years ago, everything was still kind of changing because, you know, we're seeing like plus size models and things like that, which I don't even agree with the word plus size. I personally don't even like that. But it's rewarding to see that, you know, the standards are changing and it's being more acceptable. And right. Even height is becoming to be more acceptable. Now in fashion shows, it's like, "Oh, are you 5'4"? Okay, well, wear your tallest heels. "Oh, are you 5'7", 5'9"? Okay, wear your short heels. Now we all are the same.
That's so strange to me too, because like height, you take, okay, so fashion essentially is showing, you know, if you're showing clothing, but it's also you're showing the woman who's wearing it or the man. And it's, you know, the two things working together, making the clothes fit on that person. And then that makes people go, "Oh yeah, this line or this item is amazing." But at its core, it's based, you know, it's playing off of our idea of attraction, right? You know, we're putting someone up that making them look good because we want to trigger the attraction part of the person's brain. Not because we're trying to turn them on, but because we want to trigger that so that they want to buy or they want to, you know, write about it. But when you think about like when it comes to attraction, like height is not really that big of a deal. You know, obviously like if you're like 2 feet tall, okay. Some people might not be attracted to somebody that. Yeah. Or if you're like an 8 foot tall woman. Yeah. Okay. But that's like the extremes, but you know, like the minimal like level that they would do modeling height before didn't make sense in the public, you know, like,
right.
You know, we were far more accepting of that in society than like that they were. So that seemed like a weird thing that they put on that.
Yeah, because fashion models have a very particular height and measurement standards, and typically age too. I think it's like 16 to 21. Mm-hmm. Most agencies want the age of a 16, well, 13 to 16. And it was like models like from Victoria's Secret, like Adriana Lima. I mean, she was discovered when she was 13 in Brazil. And like, I think it's Alessandra Ambrosio. I think I might have butchered her last name. She's one of the highest paid models, and she's a wonderful model. And so I kind of look at that experience that I had, where it was kind of eye-opening to that world and what I was about to enter into. And when I got set up with the photographers, the second photographer had sat me down and he said, listen, you haven't done this before. You're not in this industry. I just want to kind of coach you and let you know that there's going to be times where, you know, someone's going to say, oh yeah, I have a camera, I'm a photographer, and they're just trying to get you naked.
Right.
And you need to be safe.
Yeah,
and make sure that, you know, everything is discussed and put into writing, because you don't want to walk into that room and be put into an uncomfortable situation.
And I think a lot of that shit happened in the 70s and the 80s. There's a lot of, and some of them being even famous photographers taking advantage of women because
of course
they could, and there wasn't a damn thing anybody was going to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's a documentary, I can't remember what it's called right now. It is about, there's this complex, apartment complex in Los Angeles. And it's like famous as the place that, where kids that are trying out for TV shows. So they have pilot season. So all these kids show up for pilot season to try out for all these TV shows and movies. And almost all mm-hmm. of them end up staying in this apartment complex. It's famous for it. I can't remember what it's called. I think the documentary is called like the Hollywood Complex or something like that. But in the documentary, you see that they have these people like just scamming these families, where they'll come in and they'll go, okay, I want to be your agent. I want to represent you. You've got a look, you've got something special. You're like a young Brooke Shields. And then they get them all excited. Oh, somebody's noticing me. Oh, awesome. And it's an agent. I need an agent. And they go, okay, what you're going to need is you're going to need a new headshot. You're going to need classes. You're going to need this. So they name out like all these 5-6 things that they need. And they go, we work with the people downstairs. Go see the people downstairs and they can hook you up with that. And what it turns out is these people upstairs that are the agents, one of them is married to the person who owns the business downstairs. So they're telling them all this stuff they need so that they go downstairs and then they spend it. And then they never get these kids any gigs. And I imagine in the modeling industry, shit like that happens a lot too. Like, how do you vet the legitimacy of somebody? You know, like, especially if they're connecting up to you via Instagram.
Well, that's why I freelance. And a lot of times, I mean, I work on a referral basis only. And that's how I basically have done it since that second photographer sat me down. And it was at that moment that a lot of models, so it's a small pool. And within this pool, I mean, there's a set of photographers and models. So we all talk to each other. And so we'll reach out to each other. Hey, have you worked with this photographer before? What was your experience? Mm-hmm. And not to say that everyone's going to have the same experience, but,
right. You
know, we do our research.
But you can at least gauge temperature.
Have to.
You know, like one negative, three positives. Okay, I get the gist.
Right. And it's all in the work too. Before, like I mean, I wasn't really picky. I loved everyone I worked with and I felt like everyone had their own style. But there was, you know, other models who, you know, they had certain demands where, okay, well, if you don't use Photoshop, then I don't work with you. Oh, and wow. I look at photography as an art. So if you are more or less about just the lighting, then I need to know that. And sometimes going into it, I'll say, well, you know, I love that you use natural light. you know, is there any way that we can edit? Would you be comfortable with this? And some agree and some don't. But you just have to discuss all that before going in. And I always ask, do you use Photoshop, you know? And because you're edited. And there's actually something going on, because when I visit New York, they were, I believe, trying to pass a law where you could not over-edit a photo. Because it was getting like to that. The point where they were extending legs and making you look taller than you were and making your eyes bigger and your cheekbones and your lips.
Oh, yeah. There was a video on YouTube about somebody doing that. I'm going to send you two photos right now. I want you to look at these.
Okay.
I think you can look while you're still on the phone, right? This is from...
Right. Yeah.
This is from Maxim. And I brought these up to share with Lam, but you brought this up. I'm like, oh, it's such a good time. It's a great photo of this girl. And then I looked at it closely and I'm like, I saw the Photoshop mistake. And I don't, you look at it right there, you can't see it at all, right? It looks like just a normal photo.
Right.
Okay, now I'm going to zoom in. It's going to be of her butt, so don't think I'm being rude. I just want you to look at what they did to her butt with Photoshop. They drew her ass crack in.
Oh my God.
Isn't that weird? Like
that looks
because the lighting was, the way the lighting was, there wasn't enough contrast to show the difference between her cheeks. So they went in and drew an ass crack. How fucking weird is that? They got to the picture and they went, oh, she looks good, but she looks like she has one big ass cheek. That's not good. So somebody went in with a one pixel black pen and an ass crack. And it looks like they emphasized, you know, the bottom of the cheek there. And it even looks like underneath her hand, you know, they emphasize that shadow.
Yeah, absolutely it does.
And for everybody listening, I will put these up on the Instagram so you guys can all see too. but yeah, I was just flipping through something. It was like, I think it's Maxim, I'm pretty sure. And it was like, says 20 or 50 sexiest women of the year or whatever. And whenever I see those lists, I'm always like, who's number one? Because I'm always curious. And this girl's number one. I'd never heard of her. So I was like looking through her photos and I just happened to like zoom in on some of the text because it was like a PDF version of it. And when I moved my hand over, I went over to that part of the photo and I'm like, whoa, that's not normal. That's not a real butt.
That's what's interesting too, is it can be a form of art because you're using Photoshop almost like painting. You're painting onto the photo. And I have total respect on that. And I don't mind if, you know, what they're changing, but I just thought it was interesting, the whole controversy like in New York about it, that they wanted to ban it.
I think, you know, there's a certain percentage maybe that makes sense. You know, it's like, okay, I changed, you know, 10% of things in here. But, you know, like if you're going in and you're changing 50% of it, like why do you even need a model?
Well, yeah, I know.
You know, like just take a picture off the internet and change that one 50%. So there's I can see where people like, maybe they just want to draw the line. You know, where's the line where it's too much?
Exactly. And I think that's was the concern, because the influence it has is, oh my gosh, you know, if you have a young girl and, oh my gosh, she's not, you know, I'm not perfect like this magazine cover. And so they felt like that kind of was, you know, destroying the self-esteem of young minds, and making it unrealistic expectations to live up to as far as, you know, the look.
Yeah, like the...
And I mean,
my boobs aren't exactly the same size. My left one's a little bit bigger than my right, but this group are exactly the same. No, they photoshopped them. That makes total sense.
And there's so much pressure and that type of influence and got to be perfect or something, you know, whatever goes through their mind. But really, it's like the imperfections are beautiful too. And it's, you know, as a model to a photographer, a lot of people don't know that you find out so much insecurities. All models have it. everyone has insecurities, and they really come out when you start modeling.
Oh, I bet.
And photographers have to deal with it. Well, they have to deal with it because the model will say like, oh, you know, I don't like this part of my body. I don't like that part of my body. And it's like, why? You're beautiful. And it kind of was shattering. It was like, I had a friend who got into photography and I was her first subject. And so she was almost like kind of, you know, confiding into me like, oh my gosh, it's like breaking my heart because I'm working with these other models. It's like, how do you not see, you know, how beautiful you are? But it's just how we've all been raised. And we are so harsh on ourselves. Well, and I don't know if men experience that.
Oh, we definitely do. Trust me. Maybe not all men, but I don't think all women experience it either, right? You know, some women think they're hot shit.
Right.
Some men think they're hot shit. but the average guy, totally. You know, whether it's people have insecurities about, like, I know it took me a long time to accept the fact that I was going bald. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm not gonna be able to have that haircut, that cool haircut. I'm never gonna be able to have that.
Right.
You know, weight, of course, you know, like gut, stuff like that, penis size, mm-hmm. all these things. Yeah, men definitely totally have insecurities about all this stuff. I assume for male models, it's got to be even worse because, you know, like having someone take photos of your body and having insecurities, it's like a magnifying glass. That's probably why they all surface.
Absolutely.
You know, like you might think you're like, oh, you know, I might think like, oh, my gut is a little big. But then when somebody takes a photo of it, now I'm like, holy shit, it's huge, you know, because now I'm looking at it. Whereas before I'm conceptualizing it in my glances at the mirror. That's tough. That's tough. But I think that part of it, you know, part of it is like that perfected image that they've, you know, like, you know, the perfect woman, the perfect man that they put up all the time, which we still do. Movies, everything like
that's very true.
You never see love story movies about average looking man meets average looking woman and they have average making love, you know.
Right.
It's always like they're super hot and you know they screw like bunny rabbits. It's never there's never that like realism of real life. But I think it has to do with magnifying those insecurities in us makes us more vulnerable to be sold things. You know,
and I definitely have that myself. I mean, you know, going into it. And there's a lot of pressure with boob size for women. And it's just kind of, it's just a thing. Because you look at women in, you know, like Marilyn Monroe, it was like, you know, 40s, 50s. These women were very voluptuous.
Right.
And then it's kind of like you get, to a point where you kind of look at women now and it's more like skinny and smaller breasts. And so then you kind of see someone else and they, oh, well, I want to have big boobs. And so that's always a factor too, or a big butt. Right now, butt implants are in.
That's so tricky.
And, yeah. Yeah.
See, I think there was that phase in the '80s too, where it was like really skinny body, big boobs.
Right.
You know, like they went from voluptuous, you know, like you said, like Marilyn Monroe, if she was around now, would be considered a plus model, which is weird.
Right. Exactly.
Like, big hips, big, well, not huge, she didn't have huge boobs, but bigger boobs. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, okay, tone down the bottom, boost up the top. And then it went to like, tone down everything, you know, we want everything small and tight. And then that was butt, and then butts came back. So it's, I guess we're having like a butt renaissance.
And that's how I feel about, that's why to me, the body is just beautiful no matter what shape and size. And yeah, that's why I like when the modeling world that it's changing because we are all beautiful and we're all different types for each other. Like I, you know, or a guy might like, you know, skinny, where another guy would like, no, I don't want a skinny girl. That's not what I'm attracted to.
Right. Well, and what's quote unquote hot, you know, whatever the socially accepted, you know, norm is only a matter of time. You know, it continually changes. You go back to like, look at the Renaissance painting of these women that they painted. They literally had like rolls in their bellies. And that was considered hot because they were rich enough to have food. So it's like, I'm rich and I can pig out, and money was attractive.
Absolutely. It was sexy.
And it just, that changes. I guess in a way, we're lucky that we moved past that, that money doesn't make you attractive anymore.
Yeah.
To some degree. Some people still believe that, I'm sure, but I think we had a lot of Playboy bunnies in the 80s that were quote unquote farm girls. So I think we got past that. Poor can be attractive now. Thank God. Because most of the world is poor. Yeah, I think that's beauty standards are just, it's hilarious. And because there is no standard, like you said, you know, like, sure. Everybody thinks the big butt thing has a lot of it's tied to Kim Kardashian, right? She does nothing for me. I don't find her attractive at all. And her butt, that one picture of like her naked butt that was on the internet, all over the internet a couple years ago, that picture horrified me. I was like, I don't find that attractive at all. But that's me.
Right. And I do feel for, you know, those girls out there who are like, okay, now I have to get this butt.
Oh, yeah.
And because, you know, it's like, enhance your natural beauty, and that's going to make you happy. And that's what I would say.
And that's a hard thing because, like you said, it's like they're getting that image of what they should do from, you know, magazines, from movies, from television, because they haven't figured out who they are yet and how they are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we haven't taught people. And I'm sure I'm 100%, well, not 100% of anything, but 90% positive that's focused more on women than men. But men do suffer from that too. You know, if you don't have a six pack, you're not hot. That's not true. You know, you have something else. You know, like some women like men with guts. I remember there was a, you know, or some women like men with white beards. You know, some older men, some like younger men. But that's who you are. And all you have to do is find the people that find that attractive. And now you get to feel sexy instead of having to change something about yourself to feel sexy. That's a weird thing to like.
It is
together in a human brain. You know, they haven't figured that out yet. They think that there's answers. They haven't figured out that the world is really more individualistic than they're told.
Yeah, develop your uniqueness and what sets you apart.
Yeah, join a metal band.
It's hard. Yeah. Exactly. That's all anyone needs to do. Yeah, I mean, my personal journey has been, I think everyone's personal journey, it just takes time and realization because, you know, again, society plays such a role. And I think I was mentioning it before, it can cause a little bit of depression.
Absolutely. Well, you feel like you're pushed outside
left
of something.
Out.
Yeah, you're like, how am I going to get in? Oh, I'm not going to get in. I'm always going to be out. And then, I think our sense of, someone told me once, our sense of how our well-being comes from how we look at tomorrow or the future. And if you don't see something interesting and something exciting, something that, you know, you don't see a happy future ahead of you, your life sucks. Because that's all you're going to think
about. Yeah, pretty much.
You're like, what do I have to look forward to? Nothing. Well, and I can understand, like, for people, for so long, for people who are overweight, like, looking at the future and like, oh, why don't you go exercise? You know why they don't go exercise? Is because, number one, same reason most of us don't want to exercise. It's fucking hard. And it's it takes a lot of fucking willpower. But then they look at it and they go, well, what if... They start thinking things like, well, what if I lose the weight and I'm not pretty? Then I'll still be out. You know, like then so they lose that ability to look forward to the future because, you know, like they've been taught to think like they lost, you know, like probably from family or something like that, or somebody talking shit to them or destroying their self-esteem. So yeah, it's hard to get over that because they don't have anything to look forward to. They're not going, I'm going to be sexy and everybody's going to love me. They're going, it's probably not going to work for me.
Yeah, and that makes me so sad. I feel like everyone carries, like, bears a cross, right? Mm-hmm. And even I have my own. I mean, I have my own depression that I suffer with. And I actually started using exercise not to, oh, I need to be skinny or I need to be sexy or, you know, fit, whatnot. It was to fight depression. And sometimes when my friends come to me and they say, hey, you know, I've been down, and I'll tell them, do not drink alcohol. Whatever you do, do not drink that. Just go exercise.
It's like doubling down.
It does. It really does bring you down. And I'll tell them, all you have to do is exercise. It releases the endorphins and it battles the depression, and just get outdoors. That's all you have to do.
It's literally the second best medicine. The best medicine being other people, you know, like being around people and human interaction. Those two things, like, they're better than any drug on the fucking market, hands down.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. And like,
I always like to remember chemicals in the brain. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Is chemicals. Absolutely.
And yeah, when you're around people and they make you feel good, it's dumping those positive chemicals into your brain. And now it's, you know, you're mm-hmm. medicating yourself. Or you're walking, and like when I go for long walks every day. I have a dog. You probably heard him shaking his collar a second ago. I take him for walks mm-hmm. every day, and we walk for at least an hour, sometimes two and a half hours. We go for really long walks. But I know that minimum, even if I have to do a quick walk with him, I won't walk anything shorter than 30 minutes, because I know for a fact that the pace that I have to go with him, that when I hit 30 minutes, that's when I get the release of the endorphins. I feel it every That's time right. at exactly 30 minutes. And I need that medication for me.
Absolutely. It makes a world of a difference on how you look out on life too.
Did you ever get into like a journaling or anything like that for dealing with depression, you know, and stuff?
I want to. I've been told it really helps. And I mean, I feel like my journalism, I've been trying to do that with modeling and photography. I wanted to do sad photography. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to show, because you go on social media and you're like, wow, everyone's smiling and happy faces. I wanted to show like something dark. I wanted to show like my past, what things that I've gone through, and kind of show like this real side to me that is frightening, because right. we don't want to show anyone that side. Right? Like there was a time when I was younger and, you know, I got strung out on drugs. I was like actually on the street.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't think I was going to come home. Neither did my family. They didn't know where I was. So that, you know, I wanted to kind of set up something where it was like, hey, what if you just show, you know, something like that? Just a picture, just someone feeling hopeless.
Right.
Feeling like they don't want to be here. And just kind of like taking it to that kind of, you know, aspect of it, spectrum of the world of modeling. I don't know if you'd call it modeling, art, whatever.
I don't remember.
An album cover, who knows?
If it was with Lamb or with Tom, I confuse my episodes with them. But one of them we were talking, I think it was with Lamb, we were talking about how there's not really any movies, and this is shocking to me, that show homelessness. You know, you see you see like one or two movies here or there where it's like, oh, this guy's homeless, but he, you know, like that Will Smith movie, Pursuit of Happiness, homeless with his kid, mm-hmm. gets a job and fixes everything. You know, it's a rags to riches story. But you never see right. about like, this dude is homeless. He's homeless at the beginning of the movie. He's homeless at the end of the movie, but this is his life.
Right.
But there are millions of people that are homeless. So we literally don't want to show that. That's why there are no movies about it. We don't want to show it because people would feel guilty.
And it's hard to see someone give up. Right. Because in a sense, people feel like that's what it is.
Right.
And we don't always know. And there's always a story there. I mean, like from personal experience, I did not want to go home. It was the hardest thing to face myself, first of all, to face what I've done, and then to face my family and how I hurt them.
Right.
It takes a lot. It was like the most scariest bravest thing I've ever done in my life. And if I could do that, I can go up on stage and I can be in front of a camera.
Oh, hell yeah. That's you nothing know? In comparison.
Nothing. Oh my gosh. And that's a real personal side of me that I'm sharing. It's a very dark side that I don't even like to look at or really express a lot of times because it was scary. I didn't like it. I didn't like that side of me.
Mm-hmm.
But we've all had, you know, we've all had some type of demon in our lives and you have to overcome it. And it's really, really hard.
One of the things that I have found beneficial about journaling is that those things, not just the darker things, the good stuff too, taking all of that mm-hmm. stuff and putting it out into the physical world. I don't understand. I can't maybe articulate this properly, but something about that process gives you a handle on things in a way that you can't just thinking about them and just feeling them. And I know that not long ago, I heard a psychologist talking about when someone is feeling anxiety or they're feeling depression or something like that, that they should say it out loud. I am feeling a little bit sad. I am feeling a little bit anxious. Because when you say it, when you speak it, it actually moves it to a different part of your brain. Now it's moved to the language center of the brain. And when it is in the language center of the brain, you have more control of it. So I imagine something like that similar is happening when you journal. So what I've found is that as, you know, like I could be angry, furious. And then once I start journaling and I see the words that I'm writing, it diffuses it. Where I'm like, oh, that's, no, I don't want to keep doing this. I don't want to feel this anymore. And you just kind of dissipate it. You know, it's not like you're turning something off and becoming a robot, but you just decide you're like, right. That's not the state I want to be in. And I would highly, highly recommend it. At least something to try. You know, don't be harsh or like, I'm going to do this every day, but whenever you feel like it, mm-hmm. write something down. It's really, it's fascinating how something that simple can have such an effect. Kind of like exercise.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. I mean, I always felt like what comes up must come down.
Absolutely.
And I think it's normal to get depressed. I feel that, you know, kind of taking a look at yourself and where you're at and, you know, is this what I want? And just having all those questions and kind of doubts, they're good for you because that helps to kind of throw you in the direction that you want to go. It's when people get lost in that rabbit hole and right. they get out.
Yeah, feeling sad is not a bad thing because if you never felt sad, you wouldn't know what happiness was like. You know, you'd just exactly. be a plateau. But yeah, it's mm-hmm. like when you dip and then you're down in there and you can't get back up, that's when things get gnarly because they're controlling you. You're no longer controlling them. Your emotions are...
Yeah, you've given in.
They say the madmen are running the asylum. Oh, the lunatics are running the asylum. That's kind of what it's like. Like, oh, the right. worst parts of me are in control right now. Fuck.
Right.
So I feel like journaling is like almost like prying the door open and be like, I'm coming back in, motherfuckers. So better get back in your cages because daddy's home. It's like three metaphors there is wonderful. Nobody wants a dad that puts him in a cage. What the fuck am I talking about?
Well, it's great that we're speaking about this because I also like to write stories.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah. So that's kind of something I've been tapping into. And there was a part of me that wanted to write, you know, books. And then I really started getting into like more like screenplays.
Wow.
And kind of wanting to see, yeah, to see if maybe I can get that to come to life. And I have to say, it takes a long time when you're working on a story.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot that goes into it.
I'm 7 years into a novel right now.
There you go.
That's extreme. But yeah, there's so many little details. I was explaining to somebody the other day. Script, I would assume, is similar in the sense that, you know, it's not like a short story where it's like, oh, this is just a couple pages. But when you're doing something longer, at a certain point, yes, you're still writing, but there's also a part of you that's organizing. You know, there's a project manager. Somebody has to remember all the details. Some, you know, like there's a part of your brain that has to serve that function of like, remember this room has carpet. So every time you talk about this room, remember it has carpet. And this character has blonde hair. So when you talk about it and you start to say her red locks, you need to change that. So you have to, there's all of those little things. So why does it take time? You know, because it's a lot of work to juggle. You know, I had somebody joke around and send me a clip of some movie where the person was talking about like the novel that had been working on for 20 years. You know, it was like a comedy sequence. And they were like, is that what you say when people ask you about you working on your novel? I said, no, I say it's taken me 7 years because it's fucking hard.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not easy, but it's so rewarding. Like, what are your influences in that? You know, what type of films are you?
I love time travel.
Oh, interesting.
I'm completely obsessed with it. Yeah. If I could go back and change, I don't know, pivotal points in my life, I would. And so I just kind of put that in everything that I write.
So what do you think about the paradox of time travel then? You know, like that if you go back and you change something, would it change
like the butterfly
so much?
Effect?
Yeah, would it change so much that you weren't able to go back in time? You know, like, I changed this person's life just by one little thing, but because of that, I wasn't born. So then I didn't go back.
Well, I kind of think that it would be like parallel universes.
Ah.
So maybe we all have tons of parallel universes because maybe, just maybe, in the future, we are completely evolved that we can go back in the past. So I could be a Julie that's living in this time period where certain things have happened to me, but there's another Julie that's living a better life.
I think about parallel universes every day. No joke. Every time not every time I do something, this, I'd be insane if that was true. Every once in a while.
Hey, why not? Let's just go there.
Every once in a while when I do something, you know, like if I almost hit my head, I will think,
right, exactly.
There's a version of me somewhere that just fucking cracked his head open.
That's exactly what I've always felt. I'm like, where that moment where you're like, oh my God, I almost got in that car accident. Oh, that person almost hit me. Well, what about the time it does?
Yeah, like somewhere I died right there.
And what stopped you from that one moment? Think about it. Like, was there something that came back in time and just saved you just at that moment? Because it feels like a miracle. It feels like something stopped you.
Right. You're like, oh, like the other day, the dog and I were crossing the street. Car went through the sidewalk, crosswalk right in front of me. Like, not looking. Yep. 3 inches.
You could probably feel it.
Oh, yeah. I felt it for sure. I felt the wind of the car. And I was thinking, I'm like, man, what's the difference right there of half a step?
It's seconds. It's like just seconds. And then you got to think back, okay, what was I doing before I left? What caused those 3 seconds?
It's crazy. I love the parallel universe theory. I've never shared this before. I have this very interesting idea about time travel. And you seem like the right person to share it with. So imagine that I have an idea of all those time travel mechanics are always a problem when writing time travel stories, right? Because if you don't use the parallel universe theory, then you have to worry about all those consequences. But what if time repairs itself? So say you're able to go back to, we'll say, 20 years ago and check out yourself 20 years ago and interact with yourself 20 years ago. So everything you're doing there is tainting the timeline, right? You know, whatever you say to young Julie is going to change her because you didn't say it to her before. But the moment you move and go back to your current, you know, the time that you're from, the time erases that you were ever there and fixes itself. And you remember it, but time doesn't.
Exactly.
That would be an interesting way to do it, where it just erases everything changed, but you got to experience it.
I love that. I absolutely could do that.
You would be the best historian in the world because you could go back and just be in every place and every time, and you're not going to screw it up. So you could be like, nope, not true. You know, Jesus actually had dreadlocks. I saw it.
Yeah.
Here's the photo even, you know.
Well, and why is it that some people are like, you know, oh, the Holocaust never happened?
Yeah,
or some
terrifying.
People say like, oh, Hitler escaped. I'm like, what are you talking about? He killed himself. He killed his dog and his wife.
Well, actually,
he killed himself.
What's crazy is I watched a few things and they think that maybe he didn't. Because so the body, this something Lam and I had talked about on the show, like when we were doing weird, like paranormal and conspiracy stuff for a while.
Mm.
And so the whole thing with Hitler's body is Hitler's body was supposedly they couldn't find it at first. And then they found part of a skull. They had the part of his skull fragment in the KGB had part of his skull fragment in like a museum in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And then in, I think it was 2005 or 2015, this researcher went over and was given access to the skull and did DNA testing on it. Now, they didn't have Hitler's DNA, so they couldn't see if it was Hitler. But what they did find out was that skull fragment was a woman's.
Oh, interesting.
So it wasn't his body.
I have to say, that's an interesting museum, too.
Right. Yeah, like, dead Nazi skull. Nazi. But yeah, there's a fair amount of evidence in South America. You know, obviously, you can't verify whether it's true or not, but there's a fair amount of evidence that can be verified that they had a plan to escape. Whether they actually did it, you can't prove it, but there were definitely plans to go from here to here and then get over to South America on a submarine. And then there are people who say they saw him, and it's crazy. It's possible. It's so weird though, but the Holocaust definitely did happen.
I know.
No legitimate theories against that.
Like landing on the moon, though. People say we'd never landed on the moon. That's another one. They're like, why is the flag waving? There's no air in outer space.
There's a Mythbusters where they went in and put the flag in the vacuum, and they're like, here's why it's wagging. Or, you know, because it's on a stick and it does this, and because there's no tension, it just keeps moving. So they proved that one wrong. I love those little... I just love that people...
I love them too, because it's fascinating to me, because I just think about parallel universes and I'm like, did we all just get mixed in with each other? Some people come from a world where, yeah, there was no Holocaust, or, you know, we didn't land on the moon and we're living in the one where we did. And then they're just crazy.
See, that's...
lunatic.
That is a far, far more generous interpretation of what I think than what I think when people deny the Holocaust, because I think for me,
I know.
I just think, oh, you're just an asshole.
Yeah. Well, because, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not believing them, but it's really interesting to me.
Oh, yeah, me too. Like, ancient alien stuff, like, I think most of it's bullshit, but I love listening to it. I love hearing it. I mean, haven't you heard? We're living in a post-truth world now, apparently.
People is that what they say? That.
Oh, yeah, because of Trump and changing the truth all the time. So everybody's like, well, we don't know what the truth is anymore. And it's kind of true. We can't verify anything anymore. So nobody wants to believe it. Mm,
though no. We have information at our fingertips.
Yeah, we just don't believe it, right? Like these flat earth guys. Like, oh, the earth is flat. But like, really? And then what's all this fucking data we're getting from the satellites? It's lies. Okay. Sure. You have fun living on your little plate. Being afraid to sail too far. Have fun with that. I'm going to take an airplane.
Fear will turn you into nothing.
there's an extreme group of the flat earthers. And they're called the spaces fakers.
I've heard about this, that they still believe the earth is flat and everything.
And they think that the earth is, you know, when we look up, what we're seeing is a projection, that there's no stars. It's all bullshit.
Then what are we in?
apparently we're living in a fucking snow globe. That's what it sounds like, right? Flat on the bottom, dome over the top. That's a fucking snow globe.
Pretty advanced for a snow globe, but okay.
I hate to tell them, you know, that's been done. That was the Christmas special of Black Mirror. That was the...
Right. Sorry, I love that show. Oh, so love that show.
Did you watch the newest season?
Yeah, with the video games. Did you see that one?
With Miley Cyrus?
No, I don't think it was that one.
There's three new ones.
There's like one where the guys go into a...
Oh, the Viper one.
Honestly, video. Yeah, yeah.
On the DL in the video game. That one was really good.
I love it. I liked it. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, the Miley Cyrus one was interesting to me because I'm watching that whole thing and she's singing that pop song and I'm like, this is reminding me of something. This song sounds so familiar. And it isn't like till like halfway through I realized I'm like, she said something like, I'm going to get what I deserve. And I'm like, oh my God, it's Head Like a Hole. She's doing a pop interpolation of Head Like a Hole. But it took me like 20 minutes to piece it together. Brilliant show,
though. So good. Absolutely.
Highly, highly, that's not underrated. I think it gets about as much praise as it should, right?
I've been trying to tell everyone to watch it, that's for sure.
Especially if you're like one of those people that used to love The Twilight Zone and those anthology series.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, I think I've taken a good chunk of your evening away from you. Hopefully you've been having fun. Sounded like it.
I've been having a great time. Thank you.
Me too.
This was a great experience.
Well, for all the people who are actually enjoying it too, that stuck around, we should probably tell them where they can find you online and whatever you want to plug. So anchors away.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, you can go to Instagram and just type in Julie_Matthews. And you can find me on Darkest Fox website underneath Julie's Favorites or Models. And you can find me on Facebook and it's Julie Matthews Endless Mirrors for Facebook. And that's pretty much my info. And all the links are there.
All right. And I'd like to try to end on sort of a bang of some sort. So do you have any parting wisdom that I can just, that way you can say something and then it'll just cut to music right after you say it.
All right. Well, you know, believe in yourself, make things happen.